The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Small is beautiful. That is one takeaway from the BBC's list of the 100 greatest films since 2000. The Beeb culled list from 177 critics around the world, and the result? Nary a top grosser in the bunch. Not that Hollywood seemed to care much, but the internet sure did. Where was Avatar, Transformers, an Indian film, comedies, films directed by women or people of color? Or as Twitter critics of the critics list observed, films that anyone has seen other than movie reviewers. Well, we've got one with us, Ty Burr, Boston Globe film critic and author of Gods Like Us. He is well aware of the chasm between critics and the mainstream movie-going masses and is here to talk with us about it. Ty, great to speak with you again.
Thanks, Virginia.
So let's get to the top 10, at least, of the greatest films according to the BBC's list.
Well, and let's keep in mind that this was a poll of 177 film critics from around the world. At number 10 is the Coen Brothers' No Country for Old Men. Not exactly an obscure film, won the Best Picture. Number 9 is A Separation, the Iranian film that won the Best Picture Foreign Language Oscar a couple of years ago. Number 8 is Yai Yai, a 1 and a 2. It's Taiwanese film. Number 7 is The Tree of Life, Terrence Malick's very controversial, free-form, impressionistic film about Brad Pitt and dinosaurs. Number 6, Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind, with Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet. Number 5, Richard Linklater's Boyhood. Number 4, Spirited Away, the animated film by Japan's Hayao Miyazaki. Number 3, There Will Be Blood. I drink your milkshake, remember? Number 2, probably one that a lot of American viewers have not seen or heard of, but it's tremendous, In the Mood for Love, a Hong Kong film by the director Wong Kar-wai from the year 2000. And then number 1, guaranteed to cause arguments at the dining room table and in the candy line at the theater, David Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
Wow. Would I be out of bounds, Ty, to say that the box office for all these combined might not equal Shrek 3?
That is probably correct, especially once you factor out No Country for Old Men. Yes, that's not the point. You know, this is an argument that film critics hear a lot. You know, why don't you like movies? Everybody else does. Our job is not to reflect popular taste. Sometimes there's plenty of overlap. We love it when a entertainment movie is actually entertaining. It's made with craft and joy and creativity rather than just cranking some product out. And in fact, you know, if you look at the BBC list, there's plenty of entertainment on there. There's like 4 Pixar movies. There's Mad Max Fury Road. We like entertainment movies when they do it well. But part of our job is also to point to and appreciate the films that push the boundary and give you an experience that you can't get anywhere else.
So for you, given that a lot of times there is this chasm between the critics' picks and popular films, were there surprises for you in what was included or maybe left out?
Oh, you know, it always comes down to a personal opinion. This is a pretty rigorous list. If somebody wants to set out and sit down and watch the movies that really expand the boundaries of what cinema can do, this is a good list to start with. I mean, and you may have your patience tested. There's a couple of movies by the Hungarian film director Bellatar, which give new meaning to the phrase slow cinema, you know. But on the other hand, there's also Moulin Rouge by Baz Luhrmann. I agree that I don't think there are enough films directed by women on the list. That's a problem with the industry as a whole, and a problem with the BBC poll, which didn't poll enough women critics, and they're out there, trust me. I think overall it's a good list that you can argue with endlessly, which is the point of these lists.
Well, you get lumped in with the joyless, snooty critics who don't choose, you know, Captain America or whatever.
But I like the Captain America movies. Some of the superhero movies I don't like, but those ones are okay. I like crap as much as anybody else. But it has to be good crap. Can I say that on NPR?
You just did. But I'm wondering if it doesn't matter now. I mean, we have Rotten Tomatoes that has, you know, one column of reviews for viewers and the other with critics like your reviews on the other side. Is that just the best way to do it?
And there is a chasm between them. And some people, especially out there in the real world, get very upset, for instance, when, you know, a superhero movie like Suicide Squad gets terrible reviews. And I know that as a critic, I am powerless to stop Suicide Squad from becoming a hit, even if I write a terrible review, and that's fine. I'd rather help the smaller movies find an audience than keep the movies that I don't particularly like away from an audience.
Ty Burr, great to speak with you as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ty Burr, he's Boston Globe's film critic and author of Gods Like Us. You can read his list of top 10 films of the millennium, as well as the BBC's greatest films from the era, according to critics. Links are at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We just heard Ty Burr's take on the top 100 films of the millennium, according to critics listed by the BBC. He sums it all up with his jazz club metaphor.
When my mom, who was a child of the 1940s, and when she was a teenager, jazz music was pretty much all there was. And when you went to hear it live, you went with all of your friends to a big arena and heard the big bands. And there was kind of no other music unless you were into like classical music. 40, 50, 60 years later, if you're a jazz fan, you don't go to a big place. You go to a small club where there are connoisseurs like you who know the history and know the music and can appreciate it on a bunch of different levels. And that's kind of how I feel that movies are sort of evolving now. You have the big budget circuses, and then you have the smaller little jazz club kind of experiences.
So if you're not a member of that dwindling club, or if you have children who don't go in for subtitles, you may get more practical film advice from Amy Diaz, editor of The Hippo and reviewer of less arcane movies. She's our real-world guide to films that may or may not have gotten a lot of hype over the summer, but are still worth watching. Amy, always great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the don't bother category. You've got one, Ben-Hur, not 1925 or 1959 version, the Charlton Heston we all saw on TV, but a new one. Here is a clip from This Is Just Before the Start of the Epic Chariot Race.
Should have stayed away.
You should have killed me.
I will.
Whoa. Jack Huston there playing a very gruff-sounding Ben-Hur. So what did they get wrong?
Everything. Every single thing. That right there was literally the best dialogue in the whole movie. All of the rest of it is terrible. There is also kind of universally terrible acting, some very egregious use of wigs that really pulls you out, also beards. Just awful from start to finish. I think this movie, it was made by the same people who've done some other, you know, biblical and religious theme movies. They tried to put in a faith element. Got that completely wrong, too. If that's what you're looking for, this is not your movie. If you're like me, you really like a good just sort of Bible story and sword and sandals, this is not for you either. The action wasn't that great. I had the misfortune of seeing it in 3D, which does it no favors. And then they like duct tape this whole thing together with some Morgan Freeman narration, which I realize he's the voice of God, but even the voice of God cannot save a total mess like Ben-Hur.
Okay, what else should we not see?
Definitely do not see Nine Lives. This was the movie, this was the Kevin Spacey in the body of a cat movie. This came out at the beginning of August. This was also a mess. It's, you know, your standard, like, the parent has a magical transformation to try to better understand the kids and the family life that he's been ignoring. That's kind of what Kevin Spacey does here, but it is so poorly done. The CGI cat is terrible. The whole thing is shrill. And I really left feeling very bad for Jennifer Garner, who needs one of these like 8-episode cable crime things to maybe get her out of these terrible mom roles that she keeps getting. Like, she needs someone to pry her out of that and make her a prosecutor or something like that. And you know, then she could sort of shake up her career.
Okay, note to Hollywood showrunners, Jennifer Garner needs a role. All right, what to see now, though, for family movies? Let's start with, we will get to the worthwhile summer blockbusters, but theaters now that you're liking.
Well, so, you know, if this is kind of the, like, last weekend of summer movies. And actually, even though we're in August, and this is when a lot of the iffier movies, I would say, come out. There are some really solid films to see. Finding Dory, which is, I think, I think it did the best of any movie this summer at the box office, is just a really solid Pixar animated movie. I took my daughter to this. This is the first movie I took her to in the theater. She's four.
Sweet.
Ellen DeGeneres does excellent work as Dory. I think she's a reason to maybe revisit the voice acting as an Oscar category.
We talked about that, right?
We have, and she totally deserves it. Does a great job, visually beautiful, just a really great on point Pixar movie.
Okay, how about the tween and upset?
Well, so if you haven't had a chance to see Star Trek Beyond, I would definitely check it out. I thought, you know, it's kind of like a really expensive one-off episode of a really expensive, you know, Star Trek TV show.
And a very different role for Chris Pine in your grown-up categories, Hell or High Water. This is a Western.
Yes, it's like a cops and robbers kind of Western. Chris Pine plays a robber. Ben Foster plays his brother. Ben Foster and then Jeff Bridges as a Texas Ranger who's chasing them are kind of doing similar things to what you've maybe seen them do before. But it's really good. It's a well-done story. These two brothers decide to save the family ranch by robbing the bank that holds the loan to the family ranch, which, as someone says in the movie,
it's foreclosure revenge.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't get more Texan than that. So it's, you know, it has kind of a fun element, a little bit of social commentary. It's just a really solid, you know, suspenseful movie throughout, good performances. And it's kind of, you know, I think people who kind of want grown-up, non-comic book movies, like, did they even make those anymore? Do they show in the summer? You know, this is a good example of one.
Here's a clip of, as you mentioned, Jeff Bridges, Texas Ranger, here driving with his colleague, talking about what he'll do in his upcoming retirement.
Who knows? Maybe one of these bank robbers is going to want a gunfight, and I can dodge my retirement in a blaze of glory.
Well, I've seen you shoot. Won't be much glory in it.
Sounds like he doesn't have any teeth anymore. Guess he's got it down.
And that shows you the relationship between these two characters. And that Jeff Bridges is doing something familiar. But it's fun. It's really enjoyable to watch. It hits that sweet spot of being kind of smart, but, you know, also entertaining.
All right. So in your notes to me about this, you include a whole category called weirdness. What's that, good or bad?
Well, so this is those August releases that are just a strange grab bag of things. There's always a movie in August that I call like the book club release. It's very much marketed towards women. Frequently, Meryl Streep is involved.
Let me guess, Florence Foster Jenkins.
Yes, exactly. So this one this year, I think, is Florence Foster Jenkins. She plays a woman who is best known for being a terrible singer, but rich enough that she can have all these recitals and performances during the 30s and 40s in New York. I kind of feel like the movie said, well, we hired Meryl Streep and we're done. That's it. We're not going to put any more effort into it than that. So it kind of hangs all of it on her performance. And there are moments where she turns in a really strong performance, but she's just one person. Even Meryl Streep can't hold the whole movie together.
That's a new one. The another one that you mentioned, Sausage Party. Interesting concept. So basically you have food.
Yes.
It's an animated feature.
For kids.
Not for kids. Yes, definitely not for kids.
I feel like I should say that many times. Not for kids. In fact, the theater I went to even has signs up everywhere in the theater that's like, this movie is animated, but it is not for children.
Okay, so this is, assembly of today's comedy giants. We have Kristen Wiig, Jonah Hill, Bill Hader, Michael Cera, Paul Rudd, James Franco. Doesn't work?
Well, it didn't work for me. And I think I'm one of the few. I saw a lot of more positive reviews. So it's hard to describe this in a PG way. But Seth Rogen voices a hot dog who is in love with Kristen Wiig, who is a hot dog bun. And they're very excited about what's going to happen when they leave the store and their life together. And then a character named Honey Mustard is returned to the store and suggests that life for food after the supermarket is maybe not as happy as they have been led to believe. And so then it becomes kind of this quest to find out what happens. It just so didn't work for me, but it seemed to work for other people. So I guess if raunch is your thing, maybe it would work for you.
Okay, so you also mentioned Suicide Squad as a fun movie that was not very fun, and War Dogs in the weirdness category. Anything quickly to say about them before we move on to some great movies we should see now?
War Dogs is basically okay. It's an okay procedural.
Based on a true story, I think.
Of
guys running, they get a contract from the Pentagon to run arms.
They sort of discovered this thing where they could get small, what for a big company would be a small military contract, but for them allows them to make all this money selling guns to the military during the, I guess, sort of the mid-years of the Iraq War, and kind of how that starts to go wrong, and they kind of are committing fraud. And it's, you know, it was not going to light the world on fire. When you see it on cable in like 4 months, it's totally going to be worth watching.
Let's hear a clip from that. This is from War Dogs. Jonah Hill and Miles Teller, I think, getting in over their heads.
Hey, seriously, is this safe driving to Baghdad?
Yes, that is safe. 50-50.
50-50, what? Like 50% we live, 50% we die?
Yes, that's why we drive through night. It's much safer.
How much safer?
50-50.
Clip there from War Dogs, one of the films in the weirdness category.
Great movie to fold your laundry to later this winter.
Amy Diaz is with us. She's editor of The Hippo, and she's got a full list of summer movies that you might have missed that are still worth seeing. The list is at wordofmouthradio.org. Okay, so Amy, how about this stuff that just flew by this summer that we didn't even think about, remember, that we can see now?
Well, so sort of available for home viewing now, some stuff from, I think, early May and maybe June. So there was a movie called Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping. This features Andy Samberg and the guys that did a lot of the digital shorts on Saturday Night Live.
The Lonely Island Club.
Exactly. And so this is kind of like the pop music version of like Spinal Tap, the popumentary
mockumentary.
And kind of gets into that. Like, he had been a part of this boy band that was kind of part NSYNC, part Beastie Boys. And now he's on his own. He's called Connor For Real is the name of this artist. And so there's kind of just a lot of little bits that are funny about that. Not everyone works, but if you're looking for just kind of a good, dumb comedy, I thought it was really solid, and it was in theaters for like 2 minutes.
All right. Another one. You mentioned Eye in the Sky. This is Helen Mirren playing a military officer in charge of drone offensive, some secret drone offensive. She wants to drop this big, powerful drone on a hideout, and I guess a young girl wanders in, triggering this high-level kind of international intrigue. I just wanted to play this clip because it's one of the last movies featuring the great Alan Rickman. Here he is. He's a general in the British Army. He's on the phone with Helen Mirren, who wants to drop the bomb.
Stamp is a British citizen. They want her alive.
They cannot have her alive. Frank, I've tracked her for 6 years. This is the closest I've ever got. So we need to expand our rules of engagement right now to protect the civilian population. A hellfire through that roof is our most effective option.
We have to know that we're legally in the clear.
So the moral complications of drone warfare didn't do so well. Do you think it's, what, too timely, too soon?
I think it's just one of those kind of grown-up suspense movies that maybe didn't find its audience in theaters. Definitely worth checking out at home. A lot of it is people in rooms trying to get other people on the phone to make sure they have the permission to do something. And that doesn't sound like really suspenseful, but it is. And, you know, it's one of these movies that has little bits of humor throughout. Really solid cast. This is not a movie you would see 13-year-olds at, but just a really solid, suspenseful, you know, kind of modern warfare movie.
All right. So what's coming up for the fall?
Well, it's a mix still. We're not quite at Oscar season. That happens later, you know, towards the holidays. But things I'm looking forward to in September, there's Sully, you know, the movie about the water landing on the Hudson. This stars, of course, by law, Tom Hanks, and is directed by Clint Eastwood. That comes out the 9th of September.
Let's just hear a clip from that. This is Tom Hanks playing Sully, the Chesley Sullenberger, I think it was his name. I can't remember. National hero when he landed the plane. It's a film by Clint Eastwood.
We are unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
It's going to be left traffic, runway 31.
Unable.
Okay, what do you need to land?
No reload after 30 seconds, and your master 1 and 2 confirm off.
Too low
off.
Terrain. Too low terrain. Too low terrain. Too low terrain.
This is the captain. Brace for impact.
Now, I admit, I didn't watch it on a big screen. I would just watch a trailer. There was no surround sound. And I know that Sully was kind of hailed as being this calm, steady man throughout, but he sounds like he's ordering Chinese in that. What have you heard about the film?
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to it. I've seen the trailer a couple of times now in the theater, and it's one of those ones where, like, even if it's just okay, it's still Tom Hanks. That even bad pizza is good pizza theory of movies. So I'm kind of, you know, like, how bad could it be? Tom Hanks is in it. Another one coming kind of along those lines. If Denzel Washington's in a movie, it's probably going to be an okay movie at worst. He's doing a remake of The Magnificent Seven,
wow,
and that opens later in September as well.
Amy Diaz, thank you so much for bringing us this list of movies. So much to do.
Thanks for having me.
Amy Diaz, she's editor of The Hippo. You can see her full list of summer movies that you might have missed but are still worth seeing and those she's looking forward to all at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Opiate overdoses and deaths have risen to crisis levels across the country. In 2015, Barnstable County on Cape Cod topped the list of overdose deaths per capita in Massachusetts. On the Cape and other hard-hit communities, the overdose reversal drug Narcan is now in common use among first responders and affected families. This story is told by those most directly involved, the addicts, family members, police, and EMS personnel who are struggling daily against the opioid epidemic.
It feels like you get to the top of the roller coaster.
Just like a tingling in the back of your neck, in your head.
And you know that feeling where your stomach just drops when you start going down?
You know, like I can feel something like coming down.
I can kind of feel it coming on.
It's like a huge rush.
Like an egg was cracked on the top of my head.
Your whole head's like on fire. That's how it feels.
When you do a lot of heroin, you feel it in your lungs.
You're like,
you feel a tightness of breath.
The lack of oxygen is what kills you.
Like, it has a direct effect on whatever it is in your brain that controls your lungs.
I
hit myself.
And I was late for work, so I used it all.
Consciously know that I was going to overdose.
And I remember, like, thinking, like, oh, shit.
You know, this is too much. And
whoa. I think that's all I said, actually. I was like, whoa.
I pulled out, and that's the last thing I remember.
Overdosing, you know, going, like, probably 30 miles an hour on a really windy,
walking
like typical
back to the
Cape Road.
Driver's seat. I guess I fell.
You know, I don't remember having any dreams or any like white light moments.
Just didn't wake up, you know?
Your eyes close and that's that.
It was literally nothing, you know?
It's just like a deep sleep with no dreams. It's just black.
You know what? It was the winter. It was February, but it was a Wednesday. On Wednesday nights, my husband and the kids go bowling, and it's my time to be home alone, and I go to bed early usually. I heard them come in, and I didn't get up or anything, and I think that there was a friend with them, and my son had to drive the friend home. The phone rang, and our son was having a hard time in the car. He had felt dizzy, and he had asked Anthony to drive for him. And Anthony looked over, and he was passed out. I got up. Like I said, I was in bed. I had my pajamas on. I put slippers on, and I grabbed my Narcan. I don't know why. He had been clean for 18 months. Got another phone call, and Anthony said he had stopped breathing, and he was close to our house, but he had seen the police at a gas station down the street from us, so he pulled in there. So I got in my car, and I drove down to the gas station, and they were doing CPR on him.
We get the call, you know, it could be, you know, an overdose, come in as a possible overdose, and we'll respond, you know, like a medical emergency, lights and sirens.
You see a call that, you know, somebody, male or female, is passed out either in a parking lot or on a bench or in a car.
You know, we get there and there's somebody passed out in the bathroom.
And they're blue and they're not breathing. That's a sign of someone that is dead or near death.
Just like any time that the body doesn't have enough oxygen, it starts affecting the brain. The brain actually is very selfish, so it starts shunting the blood away from the extremities. And that's why the fingers will start turning blue and the lips will start turning blue, because to the brain, those parts aren't important.
on the side of the gas station. I think there were two cruisers, and they had him on the ground between the cruiser and the store. His shirt was off or unbuttoned, or his chest was exposed. It didn't appear to be breathing. I was scared to death. I believe at that time they told me they had found a needle. So I said, I've got Narcan. I was all thumbs at that point. I kept dropping it. So I said, Donna, you got to put your big girl pants on and do this. So I went and sat in front of the police cruiser because the lights from the headlights were good. And I put it together and I went and gave him the Narcan and nothing happened. So I went back down and put my second vial together. And at that point, one of the paramedics who I know well came over and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, it's okay, Don, I'm here now. And he took the Narcan from me and he gave the second dose.
Within a minute, you can start to see the color come back in their face, chest start to rise, and then...
He came to and he said he could hear me talking and he knew everything, you know, was... Okay, he doesn't know what happened before that.
An off-duty cop found me, like, in the woods, on my dashboard, not breathing.
They just saw a kid that was passed out in his car.
A security guard found me and got me inside.
The EMTs gave me Narcan.
They said I was the color of a blue Gatorade when I woke up in the hospital.
I woke up in the back of an ambulance, two EMTs.
With a cop standing over me.
I saw my brother, and then I saw the nurse in front of me.
I woke up more just confused and overwhelmed.
I was like, what the heck just happened?
With like a pounding headache and like in a neck brace.
I had pulled out into two lanes of traffic. They had to break me out of the car.
I was in shock. I didn't even know what to tell them. I was embarrassed. I was thankful.
There are people who wake up and are confused. There are some people that wake up swinging. There are some people who wake up yelling, and then there are other people who just wake up.
Understand that if a person overdoses and they're given Narcan, they immediately go into withdrawal. And now the dope's sick. I think everybody's heard about people going into the emergency room and coming out and shooting up in their car before they even leave the parking lot.
I know we've had an individual like multiple times in one weekend. I know that, so it could, you know, within the same, probably twice in the same 24-hour period. Obviously, just they're not ready to, you know, for recovery yet, and they just keep on using.
Have people, you know, overdosed and used Narcan and used again? Sure. It's not a treatment plan, but it enables people to stay alive.
You keep hoping that this time that you've given someone Narcan is the time that they decide to go get help.
I'd like to say that was the end of it for him, but it wasn't. The calling is more than something I can understand.
Imagine sitting at a table and like being famished, like wanting to eat so bad, and the food's right in front of you, and knowing that that food is slowly killing you. Like, but how do you tell somebody like, oh, don't eat? It's like, I'm hungry and it's hardwired into me. I'm gonna be hungry. To resist that urge is really tough. I had trouble stopping.
Like, I couldn't stop when everybody else was, you know? And
and it's tough to know exactly when it changed to, you know, I have no control over this anymore.
Somewhere out there in the world, there's, like, a ATM security tape of me, like, crying, taking money that wasn't mine.
You know, I wasn't getting high anymore. There was no high.
Say to myself, please help me get this thought out of my head.
It was seeking out drugs just to feel normal again.
Whoever you are, God, whoever it is, just help me get this thought out of my head.
He actually had overdosed 17 times. Unless you have it in your heart, you know, the brain says, I want to be clean. It doesn't always work that way because sometimes I think the body, the disease of the thing sucks you in so much. He had been in a detox at Gosnold. He had just come out about 5 days before that. And it was the first time I absolutely said to him, you are not coming home. And he called me the next morning. He said, Mom, I really want to get into this sober home, but I'm afraid if I'm not home that I'll never stay clean to get there. So I said, okay, come on home. So he did. He was safe at home with me. But you're never safe. It doesn't matter where you are, you're never safe. I came home and found him. I always feel like when you're thick into this disease of addiction, you have three alternatives: recovery, jail, or death. Because there's really nothing else. He's done all three now.
I always make sure that I don't say never will I ever use again. I don't want to ever use again, and I'm going to keep working towards that.
But I don't know, I try not to look too far down the road. I try to, like, you know, it's corny and it's cliche, but I really try and keep it in today.
I know I don't want to use today, and I know I probably won't want to use tomorrow either.
I got clean again, and I've been clean ever since. 20 months.
3.5 years now?
It'll be 3 years in July.
I feel good. I feel real good. I feel like I'm never turning back now. I have too much to live for.
And that story was produced by Ryan Swigert at the Transom Story Workshop. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. So it's time for Overheard, and we have two of our eminent guests from the newsroom in today. Jack Rodolico, our health and science reporter here at NHPR. Natasha Haverty is with us. She is our State of Democracy reporter. Hello.
Hey, hello.
How are you?
We got this together.
We did.
We did it.
Yeah, here we are.
All right, who gets to start?
Natasha.
You guys, no rock, paper, scissors, or anything.
Paper, scissors. One time.
I know what you're going to play, and I don't want to follow that. So,
okay.
Natasha, that means you.
After you, then.
What have you brought with you?
Okay, so I brought in something by Elaine May and Mike Nichols, who were this duo in the 50s who improvised together.
They were married, weren't they?
No. They
never married.
They were involved really briefly. So they were in that crew in Chicago that, like, were the first kind of improvisers. But then they hit it off so well when they started working together that they just went off and did their own thing. And what's really cool is that in addition to performing together on stage, they did a lot of radio stuff. So they had, like, their radio show and then all these outtakes that you can listen to. No, they were involved, but they never got married.
And Mike Nichols was a great director, The Graduate. What else did he do?
A lot. Carnal Knowledge. Like, a lot of things. Closer was one of his last ones.
Stage director and film director. And also Elaine May.
Virginia Woolf was also both. Yes, she was a director too.
So they were a comedy team.
And there's just all these awesome recordings of them playing around. The one that I've brought in for you guys is actually from one of their albums that's called Improvisations to Music. And the idea of this album was they had a pianist who would start playing a piece of music, and then it was for them to improvise whatever scene went with it. This one I love because you hear them kind of, like, subverting what the scene wants to be with the music.
All right, let's hear it. Nichols and May.
I bet you don't know your zone.
Pardon?
I was just saying, I bet you don't know your postal zone. I was talking with a couple of the fellas today. Nobody knows his zone.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't. Isn't that funny? I don't. And I lived in the same place for years and years, and I don't.
It's something you just don't remember.
Yeah. Oops.
Sorry.
I keep losing.
Yeah. There's a lot of things like zones, you know, that you're not going to remember, but your zone, you want
to. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, if somebody is going to write to you, you know, so many times people have said, what is your address and what is your zone?
Yeah, and you didn't
know
it.
I have never known what it was.
Yeah.
And it gets there faster.
Two, three, what? Faster when you say what the zone is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because?
Well, they sort it that way.
You dip?
They sort it by zone.
The mailman, yes. Yeah.
So it's going to be faster.
Yeah. Have you been up here long?
No, it's my first week.
It's sunny.
Would you like to try a little ping pong?
Oh my goodness.
Love to.
This is the most awkward thing I've ever heard. That's wonderful. It's painful.
Well, it's so great that it was an album. First of all, that it's life before zip codes, but also like that they made an album out of it. Like they thought it was good enough, and it is. It's so like their rhythm is fantastic.
Yeah, they're like they found what their game is, and they're playing with it. And it's also so visual, even though it was just for audio. Like you can totally picture these two people stepping on each other's toes, and they're like giving us enough pictures that we can imagine that, even though it's just for our ears.
So did you get this off of YouTube or?
No, this is an album I actually own. And I bought it on iTunes for today.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Big money.
Then.
You can expense that, Tasha, just to let you know. Jack, what have you got for us?
I have a recording, very low-tech recording of my son.
Your new
my
son?
My new son,
How
yeah,
old is he now?
He's going to be 4 months next week.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And tell everyone his name because it's so spectacular.
It's Giacomo.
Giacomo, what's the middle name?
Giacomo Joshua.
Rodolico?
Rodolico, yeah.
That's like a song right there.
It is. Yeah, we get a lot of comments on the name. It was my great-grandfather's name.
All right, so what did you record?
He's just talking now. So it's
at
it's
4 months?
Well, he's not, you know, he's babbling now. He's a genius. He's reciting sonnets. He just started blathering, you know, one day it just started very quietly, and then very quickly it just turned into him looking you right in the eye. I mean, people who have kids won't be surprised maybe, but I think it's the most amazing thing that I've ever heard and seen.
All right, let's hear it.
So when he's not talking, he looks away from me.
Okay, that is kind of exceptional, isn't it? I mean, I know everyone thinks their child is exceptional.
I think he's exceptional.
He is exceptional.
He is, clearly.
He will look at you and make whatever noise he wants to make. Sounds like a dolphin in there for a little bit. And then he just looks away and kind of spaces out. And then he comes back to you and he's like, blah, blah, and just keeps going. What I'm realizing with the way babies develop or the way humans develop is that their precursor things they do and before they do the thing that they'll do when they're bigger. So before he starts crawling, he starts moving like he's crawling. So on his back, he actually looks like he's crawling. And before he starts actually talking, he just starts making noises. And even before he mimicked sounds, he mimicked your mouth. So from day one, he would try to, if you made an O or stick your tongue out, he would stare at you and then do it. And this is what babies do.
They're trying to make you love them, from
yes,
what I understand.
It doesn't take much. Yeah.
Do you think when he's like spacing out, do you actually think he's spacing out, or do you think he's like looking away because he needs so much focus to come up with the ability to then do the next babble?
It could be both. I think sometimes, you know, his attention span is just so short.
Yeah.
But then other times, I think it does look like he's gearing up. You know, he says something and then he looks like someone who's really stopping to think and ponder the next thing he's going to say. And then I told him, blah, 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 you know. But instead it comes out as, ah, ah, ah. Yeah.
It's so interesting. This is, you know, probably within the last 5-10 years, the first generation of babies that are going to be easily documented throughout their entire lives.
My mother gets really ticked at me if I do not send her a photo every day. Yeah. I've gotten really scathing texts from my mother. At one point she said, stop the flim-flamming and send me pictures of my grandson. He's in demand among this small audience of people.
Well, I have one that sort of works on the human brain as well in a different way. I did an interview with a woman who wrote a book about how to choose a partner in a very sort of, you know, philosophical, scientific, psychological way. She's from the School of Life. It's kind of like self-help for really thinky people.
Yeah.
And one of the things I read in the book was that the hormonal change that goes on with people in the beginning of a relationship, those first sort of flickers of love, is like people with OCD. You know, so you're completely sort of fixated and obsessed on this one thing, or you keep replaying in your mind the kind of sounds. And it reminded me of a podcast I heard called from Audio Smut, which has, you know, I guess gone through some rebranding and now it's called The Heart. So no more Audio Smut. So this woman, Caitlin Press, was the producer, but she worked with a composer, Shani Everam. And they did a bunch of research on relationships and did interviews with 17 different people. And then they put together this kind of radio play based on this one woman, Caitlin, meeting a woman named Ray, kind of them having a fast sort of torrid, you know, stapled together series of days. Caitlin's texting her like, you know, this time, she's trying her over and over again. And here's nothing back. And she's sort of getting desperate.
11:05 a.m., Ray. I miss you.
That's heavy.
It's the truth.
Why don't we try something lighter?
Ray. What's up? How's your day going? I have to go to the bank around the corner from your house later this afternoon.
Ray.
I'm heading to the bank later.
Ray.
I'm doing some errands in your nabe later. You want to go for a stroll before or after? Doing some errands in your nabe. 5 p.m. Are you around? Doing some errands in your nabe. Shoot me a text.
Yeah, I love that.
It's like chaos in
your
mind.
Go for a stroll is such like the thing you say. Like go for a walk is even too heavy. But like go for a stroll. It's like, oh, we're just accidentally walking together.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't been in that state in a long time, but the sort of like, oh, should I say that? No, that's too heavy. You know, that kind of thing.
I'm so glad I haven't been in that state in a long time.
I've been in that state pretty recently, guys. So just cut it out.
So what we're saying is that this is normal behavior, I guess. We heard it on the radio. But actually, let me play the other clip, and then I want to talk with you guys about your thoughts.
You're a weird old lady, maybe?
She didn't say I was a beautiful woman. She said,
strong. When I think of Nancy, I just think of, like, strong, beautiful woman.
It was a strong and beautiful name.
I used to use kind of a weird old lady name, but...
We were into each other. Nancy, I just think of, like, she just... isn't
beautiful
into it anymore. So we were texting every hour on the hour. It's in my phone. It's right here.
A beautiful name for a woman. I want to do everything.
What changed? I just want to call her, but couldn't she just tell me something changed? I can't call her again. At what level of closeness is it appropriate to have an emotional conversation with a person? What level of closeness do you have to be with a person to be able to break up? Am I crazy? I'm f***ing crazy.
I'm just daydreaming.
About what?
About you.
I forgot to tell you that the title of the piece is great. It's called The Movies in Your Head.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Like how you start sort of, the script starts rolling
totally.
When you meet someone.
Yeah, I like how there's some of the voices sometimes sounds like it's right in your ear and sometimes like down a hallway, because that is kind of what's going on in your head much of the time. There's like louder voices and quieter voices and sometimes they swap, you know.
Yeah, it gave me like a stomach ache listening to that.
I know, poor Caitlin. But it's a composite of a lot of different people. But, you know, that's the thing. Like, you're in radio, right? You use radio for this kind of sense of place. And obviously, when you talk to people, you hear what's revealed through their voice. But I love that this is kind of revealing a mental state through audio.
Yeah,
totally.
I thought it was well done.
I'm really feeling a theme in the three pieces we brought, which is the struggle to communicate love or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Like the Nichols and May, they're like this awkward couple and they like want to have a good date, you know, but they just keep like not hearing each other. And then like Gia is just pure love, but he just literally can't talk yet. And who knows what's behind those babbles. And then the heart, it's like all that girl wants to say is, hey, let's go for a walk because I have a crush on you. But we just can't. It just can't be that simple. That's my theme.
I'm gonna buy that. I'm gonna take it.
I couldn't come up with a better one, that's for sure. That's good.
Natasha Haverty, theme caller and State of Democracy reporter here at New Hampshire Public Radio. Natasha, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Health and science reporter Jack Rodolico, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We will put a link to more Nichols and May material and also a link to The Movies in Your Head from formerly Audio Smut, now The Heart. All that, wordofmouthradio.org. And here's what you overheard on today's episode. Music from Dan Seste, Blue Dot Sessions, Yee Yee, and Broke Free. And you can listen to the whole show or share today's segments with your friends. The links are all on Facebook, Twitter, and at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thank you for sharing some of your listening time today. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.